Hello everyone, my name is Elijah David, Minister of the 12th Hour Apostolic Cemetery and Congregation of the 12th Hour. In the Liberty Hill, Texas, today is December 3, 2016, or in the Seabed 5, 2020. We will start our first service on the Sabbath day with a song entitled, Anywhere with Yahshua I Can Safely Go. Anywhere with Yahshua I can safely go. Anywhere he leads me in this world below. Anywhere without him, dearest, yours would fade. Anywhere with Yahshua I am not afraid. Anywhere, here I cannot know. Anywhere with Yahshua I can safely go. Anywhere with Yahshua I am not alone. Other friends may feel me, he is still my own. Though his hand may lead me over dreary way. Anywhere with Yahshua is a house of prey. Anywhere, anywhere, there I cannot know. Anywhere with Yahshua I can safely go. Anywhere with Yahshua I can go to sleep. When the gloomy shadows round about me creep, knowing I shall waken nevermore to roam. Anywhere with Yahshua will be home, sweet home. Anywhere, anywhere, there I cannot know. Anywhere with Yahshua I can safely go. White House recruited by the V.T. Hartef. We're going to do, start with page 3. 1951, the V.T. Hartef. It says, never did the clouds of war so strange and so dark hang in an angry thunder head over the world, and never did the world see itself as it does today. Everywhere the government industry, in the halls of learning, in churches, in homes, on the streets, in every walk of life, the question uppermost is, whither bound mankind? From the preeminent scientific and journalistic spokesman come such representative utterances as these. What is the story of man? It is that men die, man survives. Now, men are measurably near the most terrible of all the climaxes they have brought upon themselves. In their long history of struggle, if the climax comes, it will change life and change the world. But it will not end life. It will not destroy the world. In this utmost climax, or perhaps in its prospect, men may at last find the secret of peace and the way to live without destruction. That is a hope. The certainty is that man will be on earth making a world. Einstein agrees that other nations can rediscover our secret processes by themselves, that no military defense can be expected, and preparedness is futile, that if another war breaks out, atom bombs will surely destroy the civilization. What is important, he went on to say, to enlighten public opinion on the real situation about the bomb. Only the prevention of war by action on an international scale, which will make preparation for war unnecessary, and even impossible can save us from its consequences. Okay, that's written in Newsweek, March the 10th, 1947. History in the large area of the world has been rolled back. Fanaticism has replaced reason. Terror, compromise, hate, friendship, science, education, and philosophy, the vehicles of progress under Western man, have been perverted, distorted, and retooled into weapons against civilization. John Edgar Hoover, in a report sent out by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the First World War was a decided shock to the earlier period of optimism. Today, the shock is almost incredibly greater. Insecurity and strife are so general that the prevailing attitude is one of the anxious and pessimistic uncertainty. John Dewey, Reconstruction and Philosophy, is only too much reason to fear that Western civilization, if not the whole world, is likely in the near future to go through a period of immense sorrow and suffering and pain. Bertrand Russell on the subject. If we are to survive this dark time, in the New York Times Magazine, September the 3rd, 1950. We have now arrived at the ultimate stage in history. What is ultimately required of us is required of us now. It is very late. Perhaps nothing can save us. But the handwriting on the wall is plain enough. It says unto this people of Israel, unite or die. Dr. Robert M. Hutchins. Everyone has agreed that an atomic war is world suicide, that no one can win. No scientist of repute doubts the fact that every country with an industrial capacity will have the atom bomb in 5 years. We therefore have just 5 years to build for peace. Dr. Robert M. Hutchins, Chancellor of Chicago University and Chicago Daily Tribune, March 26, 1946. There can be no doubt about the world crisis. We are living at one of those turning points of history, which offers two roads, one of which leads to death and the other to life. The fact is, the H-bomb represents mankind's final suicidal triumph, the unlocking of the inmost secrets of nature for the purposes of total destruction. It brings into obsolete focus the failure of a materialistic civilization which has sought to organize its life apart from Yahweh. G. Ashton Oldham, formerly Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Albany, on the world crisis and the future, in the Bulletin of the Church Pacific Union for June. People are discovering a frightful queerness has come into life, even unobserved. People are betraying by fits and starts a certain wonder, a shrinking fugitive sense that something is happening so that life will never quite be the same. So spread out and examine the pattern of events and you will find yourself face to face with a new scheme of being hitherto unimaginable by the human mind. Writers are convinced there is no way out, around, or through the impasse. It's the end. H.G. Wells, Los Angeles. Examiner, October 21st, 1945. In the thoughtfully considered opinion of these eminent on-the-scene observers, this generation is at the zero hour of the civilization. Whether we realize it or not, the day of the doom is shortening its shadow, and we are face to face with the most momentous issues ever to confront a generation of men. Now, if that was true back in 1951, how much more is it true today? We're talking about 65 years plus ago. It says that what atomic warheads, it says, whether we realize it or not, the day of doom is short in its shadow. We are face to face with the most momentous issues ever to confront a generation of men. Atomic warheads, lethal rockets, poison gas, bacterial bombs, super submarines, boring through the mighty deeps, and supersonic aircraft stabbing through space above. What mean these and other dread devices of destruction? What do these signs of the times portend for the church and for all the world? Had the question flung itself at any generation in the days of Yahweh, ancient prophecies, then beyond doubt they would have answered, as the church lives, and as it is certain that Elohim lives, it would be impossible that he leaves his people in the darkness concerning the signs of their times. And their answer must certainly be our answer too. Moreover, it is a self-evident fact that if we want to know, Elohim will enable us to know the true meaning of this unprecedentedly destructive thing. From the outset, this much is clearly manifest. If the super bombs, super bombers, and super all import nothing else, they without question threaten civilization. A faint idea of the devastating and demoralizing consequences of their use is to be gained from the scene of actual destruction depicted on aerial destruction depicted on the cover page. Manifest too is the certainty that heaven has permitted these instruments of destruction to come in order to rouse Christendom, ministry, and laity alike to a concerted, enlightened, all-out action as the Yahweh leads ahead to save man from himself and from the devil. Christianity is failing at this task and leaving the world to save itself as best it can. The enemy will ere long wipe out not only the knowledge of Yahweh and of salvation, but also civilization itself. That's exactly what Obama set up to do when he took office in 2009, 8 years ago. That was his whole aim. So if it was lurking back then, 65 plus years ago, it certainly is present truth more so today than ever. So I'll read that again. Christianity failing this task and leaving the world to save itself as best it can, the enemy will ere long wipe out not only the knowledge of the Yahweh and of the salvation, but also civilization itself. Indeed, every open-eyed observer can distinctly see that while heaven and earth wearily wait upon the Christians to take the offensive against all unrighteousness, the power of evil is exerting an utterly sinister influence through the Christless men and women such as bear the red torch of communism. Okay, well, you know, the United States have been bearing this red torch of communism ever since 1830, at least. The birth of communism in this country was about 1830 in Chicago, Illinois. That's the most evil city in the United States today, is Chicago. Grim, indeed, is the picture, and the stark peril of it hurls its challenge at Christendom as a whole. What shall we do about it? Close our eyes, tight to it, or arise in the face of it, and be Noah's, Gideon's, David's, Elijahs, Daniels, Luthers, and all such with the faith to do something about it while the light still shines and while opportunity still remains us. But we lay well to the heart the tragic truth that the sin of the world's impenitence lies at the door of the church. Will we all accept the supreme annunciation, glory unto Yahweh in the highest, and on earth peace, goodwill toward men? Luke 2:14. As the supreme trust and duty of the church more than of the state, our country, and the whole world need the church, and Yahweh is waiting for her members, both laity and the ministry, to arise shine, Isaiah 60:1. Every Christian who truly knows what the gospel is, that the gospel is the power of Yahweh unto salvation, know that if the masses were converted into Yeshua, they would could not be any aggressive communistic or other totalitarian power in the world, and therefore no such threat as militant communism now presents under the civilization. And every Christian also knows that there is no power on the earth other than the sword of the Spirit that can cut off the head of the Goliath of the today. What pity then, and what necessary or recreancy to trust should the church not immediately lift from the shoulders of the state her own neglected part, which is the greater part of the burden of the peacemaking, but something to leave a government, to bear the whole load and to do the best it can without divine enlightenment and without power which only the church can impart. And virtually pushing the church out of all communist dominated countries, the enemy has already stolen a long and victorious march on her and is now fiercely fighting to extend his victory and the final triumph in pushing her from the very face of the earth. But there is yet hope if only she will, in a courageous loyalty, respond unto the divine command now ringing forth unto every defender of the faith. Arise, shine, for thy light is come, and the glory of Yahweh has risen upon thee. For behold, the darkness shall cover the earth, and gross darkness the people, but the Yahweh shall arise upon thee, and his glory shall be seen upon thee. And the Gentiles shall come to thy light, and kings the brightness of thy rising. Isaiah 60:1-3. And the power craves rule, or ruin, war-bent and hell-bent, self-destructive course of mankind, and the angry and catastrophic upheavals and outbreakings of the elements of nature, and in the cumulative fulfillment of the fast unfolding prophecies in the word of Yahweh, the signs of time, thunder, the warning appeal that we arise, and Elohim's light, and make haste to rescue his people from the ill which threatened to devastate the world. If such is not the church's great mission and duty at this crisis hour, what need then do the Yahweh and the world have of her? But what can the church do unless her members, both lay and clerical, arise together as one man and throw their all into the conflict? Well, knowing as we do the answer to these urgent questions, what excuse will we have if we do not now arouse ourselves and all saints in Christendom along with us to do what the gospel commands us to do, regardless how dramatic and impressive any demonstrations the church may put on. It is no secret that even if she is not pushed out of any place or country, still at her present pace of preaching the gospel of the kingdom at temporal millennium will not suffice her in which to warn the world, finish the work, and bring the kingdom in. And every enlightened mind knows this to be the inevitable truth. Just look at the brute predatory forces loose and lurking everywhere, and causing the whole earth to erupt with violence, tumult, and terror. Really, they are making men's hearts to fail them for fear and for looking at those things which are coming on the earth. Luke 21:26. Will not all Christians everywhere be aroused by these things to put on the whole armor of Yahweh and to take the sword of the Spirit, Ephesians 6:11-17? While following the Yahweh as he leads ahead, if not, then certain it is that the church and the world as well are hopelessly doomed. To be sure, though, the few who do arouse to make the total surrender which the hour demands, Elohim will save from the conflagration to come. How, though, shall he deliver anyone who fails to heed the signs of times, the thunderings, the dread drums of doom's day, now flashing in our eyes and rumbling in our ears with a warning more awful than the flaming thunders of Sinai? No, he could no more deliver such spiritually blind, deaf, and dumb incurables than he could have delivered the antediluvians who failed to go to Noah's ark. And now what do the flying saucers add to the already grim picture, whether they are earth-produced mechanisms or celestial and interplanetary planetary spaceships? They paint still grimmer the picture for the sinner. One may be incredulous, another startled at the thought of heavens having flying saucers, but why? If Elohim has given man knowledge to develop aerial mechanism, no one can reasonably suppose that heaven does not have incomparable superior ones. Let us not forget what covered a whole mountain in Elisha's day, 2 Kings 6:17. To be sure, Elisha called them chariots. If they were not flying saucers of some type, how did they come into the earth? For it matters not what one calls them, it's what they are and what they do that counts. But they, what they be they what they be, however, the signs round about us unmistakably warn that the thick black clouds, the globe around are consolidating to pour down upon a shelterless world the most terrible storm since time began. And all who have an ear to hear and an eye to see, the signs of the times reveal that we are fast coming face to face with a time of trouble such as never was Daniel 12:1. A clear grasp of the terrible potential of the weapons now available can leave no doubt of the global peril in the picture. Every one of us knows that if the flying saucers are secret military weapons of the White House, then other nations besides ourselves will soon have them too, if they do not have them already. If so, what then can they be designed for but to snuff out lies, even the lies of the elect, if possible? And if the flying saucers are indeed the Yeshuas or Yahwehs, then what else are they come but for to deliver everyone whose name is found written in the book Daniel 12:1, and to slay those who oppress them, Isaiah 66:16. Or if perchance none of heavens are yet come, still nothing is more certain than that the day hastens greatly when they will come. What is of first and supreme importance to each, however, is to know for a surety that his name is written in the book. To have this most blessed assurance, one must first know what will keep one's name out of the book and what will put it in. One of the many things that will keep one's name out of the book of Yahweh is one turned the death rid of Yahweh's warning that he who puts his hand to the plow then looks back, he who starts in the gospel work then turns away from it, is not fit for the kingdom, Luke 9:62. The fact is that all who have graduated from the ministerial colleges have already put their hand to the plow. Will they now turn back? We devoutly hope not. To us Seventh-day Adventists in particular, the meaning of what we see around us should be window clear, making manifest that the time has now come for every church member to engage in the proclaiming the three angels' messages. There are moreover thousands of pastoral posts now waiting to be filled with both graduates and undergraduates of Seventh-day Adventist ministerial colleges. So let no one with such qualifications any longer be found either standing idle or engaging in secular occupation while the Yahweh's work languishes and waits. At this very hour, millions without hope are wasting and withering away, perishing in the fields of sin and on the fields of battle, because no one has won them unto the Yahshua with the everlasting gospel. Who will go for them? Who has the vision, the heart, and the will to go out and the rescue of humanity for the Yahshua? For all college graduates, undergraduates, and Bible workers who have the ability and the will to equip themselves for the work, both the opportunity for service and the means for upkeeps and traveling expenses are ready and waiting. Hence there are no grounds for, and I pray thee have me excused. Luke 14:18. Inspiration's appeal, arise and shine, is to every soul. Will you not respond, brethren? Will you not earnestly pray for yourself and for other laborers to help gather in the precious golden grain? Or will you fail in this unforgiving responsibility and forfeit this most lofty privilege? The issue is of the greatest gravity. He foreknew it would be, and as a supreme concern, he projected it in the crowning lesson of his parable of the vineyard. Now keep in mind, when we say vineyard, we're talking about the parable of the kingdom. Vineyard is the same thing as kingdom. Now that the time has come to the last parabolic hour, and V.T. Hallis called the last parabolic hour the 11th, okay, and we know that Yahshua said it's 12 hours a day, and we're working in the 12th hour right now, for he has set the parable ablaze with light to be progressive as truth. Itself is, let us look deeper into this parable now while the light of Elohim is shining on it. For the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is a householder, which went out early in the morning to hire laborers into his vineyard. Now keep in mind, it's going to hire laborers into his kingdom. And when he had agreed, and his kingdom is his church. And when he had agreed with the laborers for a penny a day, he sent them into his vineyard, kingdom, or his church. And he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and said unto them, go ye also into the vineyard. So he went out into the marketplace, where the laborers were standing idle. Well, where were the laborers at? They were in the church. So, he went to the kingdom, he went to the vineyard, his vineyard, and he found the laborers that was there to be hired, he found them at the house. They weren't out in the field, but they were at the house. Waiting for somebody to come along and hire them. They were in the marketplace. The marketplace is in the church, but they were idle in the church. In other words, They were in the marketplace, but they were in the church, but they were idle. And my favorite God I will give you, and they went their way. Again, he went out about the sixth and ninth hour. He went out in 1833, sixth hour, and he went out in the ninth hour, 1844. He hired the Seventh-day Adventist. He hired the First-day Adventist in 1833, William Miller, the sixth hour, at the end of the sixth hour. He hired the Adventist at the end of the ninth hour in 1844. So William Miller apparently then worked in the seventh, eighth, and ninth parabolic hour. And the Seventh-day Adventist worked in the next 2 hours, the tenth and the eleventh hour. And Elijah David with the Isaac Branch message, and with the Mount Zion in the 12th and at the 12th hour, House of David, Tribe of Judah, Lawgiver, that's who we are. We have taken the place of the ninth hour later, it's called the ninth hour, the Adventist. We are the fifth group pointed out there in Matthew 20, verse 5, that last group of laborers. There's only five groups pointed out there in Matthew 20. And we represent that last group here, the house of David, and the judgment of the living period. Okay, so he says likewise. And about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing idle. And saith unto them, why stand ye here all the day idle? They say unto him, because no man hath hired it. He saith unto them, go ye also into the vineyard. Alright, and whatsoever is right, that shall ye receive. So in other words, he's saying, go into the kingdom. Go into the kingdom, and whatsoever is right, that shall ye receive. Matthew 20, verse 1 to 7. How can we know for a certainty in which hour we find ourselves, and if our own call to service has come? We can know only by establishing the time in which the last parabolic hour expires. And under this, we must first establish the time of the first call for service, then in turn the time of trouble, successive calls culminating with the last. First, though, pursuant to this end, we must bring into focus the parable's significant point. Number one, the householder, as every Bible student knows, is the Yahshua himself. Okay, this is true. Yahshua is the householder. The laborers are his servants, number two. And number three, the penny is a reward. Number four, his vineyard is the place where they are to labor. Okay. And when Yahshua comes to sit upon the throne of David here in this 12th parabolic hour, what's he going to do? What's the first thing he does when he comes and sits upon the throne of David? That's Luke 1:32 and 33. That's the parable. Oh, that's the prophecy there in Luke. He comes to sit upon the throne of David here on this earth in the 12th hour. What does he do? He places where Yahshua goes to work in his kingdom that he has set up. This is Yahshua's own kingdom. It's the kingdom of heaven that he set up here on earth and the throne of David. So what is the first thing Yahshua do when he comes back when he comes back and takes his place upon that throne? Actually, before he takes his place upon the throne as the king of kings, he comes back, he comes to the threshold of the house, he reckons with his servant of the and the kingdom of Ernest W. Johnson, 2002. He vetted him out, he changed him out, and he appointed a new leadership, that was Elijah David, to take up the 12th hour, the judgment of the living, and the harvest time. So what did Yahshua do? He elected his faithful servant, antitypical David, and he empowered him then to take over his kingdom. His visibly take over his kingdom. And Yahshua then, by his own power in the Holy Spirit, he goes to work through Ezekiel 9 and going through the city with writer's ink horn by his side and marking all of that are sign of crimes and abominations. This is a judgment scene, folks. This is Yahshua going to work in his own kingdom that he has set up. And his underservant, Elijah David, and many helpers with him. And as soon as Yahshua himself harvests the 144,000, so it shows right there that Yahshua is laboring in his own vineyard. He's laboring. He's not only the householder of the vineyard, but he's also a laborer in his own vineyard. Now, how did owners in the past, how did the owners of vineyards become owners of the vineyard? First, they went to work. And they made money, and then they went and bought them a vineyard. And they went to work in their own vineyard, yet they're the householder of that vineyard, but they went to work in their own vineyard, and naturally they hired others too. But the householder will work in his own vineyard. Okay, so it says, for the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man that is a householder. Yahshua is the householder. That's what it says right here. The kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man that is a householder. So, the man that owns a vineyard, that's his kingdom. And the house that he lives in is his palace. And he's a king upon the throne in his own household, which went out early in the morning to hire laborers into his vineyard. And when he had agreed with the laborers for a penny a day, he sent them into his vineyard. Who were the ones that he agreed for a labor for a penny a day? It was the first ones he hired at the early morning hour, Matthew 20, verse 1 and 2. And that was the children of Israel with Moses at the helm. Yahshua is a householder. He went with Moses to bring him out of Egypt. So he bargained with them for a penny a day coming out of Egypt. Okay, so now, that's the only ones that he bargained with until the last ones. Those that was closed out the vineyard, that was the fourth group of laborers. Okay, now I'm going to show you something here. And he went out about the third hour, and that was in 27 A.D. when Yahshua went out about the third hour. Okay, that he hired labor and saw others standing idle in the marketplace. That was the disciples. And he found 11 of them right off. And he hired them. And yet the Pharisees and the Sadducees were still in charge of the temple. They were in charge of the temple at that time. And he hired the disciples to go work in the kingdom, in the vineyard, right there in Jerusalem, and to go to work among their brethren and the people that was living in and around there. So, they were standing idle in the marketplace, and he said unto them, go ye also into the vineyard, go into the kingdom, go back into the church where the Pharisees and Sadducees are in charge of it. That's the vineyard that you're to go work in. The one that rightfully belongs to you all, but the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they have usurped their authority and power. They've taken over Yahshua's vineyard. Okay, and whatsoever is right, I will give you. So he told the disciples, Yahshua told the disciples, says, go back into the temple there where the Pharisees and Sadducees are ruling at, and go and work among those poor little people, the peasants and so forth that comes in to worship there from all over the country. Go work among them, and whatsoever is right, I'll give you. Whatever is right, I'll give you. For your pay. And they went their way. Again, he went out about the sixth hour, that's 1833, and ninth hour, and did likewise. So It didn't say that the third hour group, it didn't say that the sixth and ninth hour group were standing idle. He just found them out there. Well, I guess they were standing idle if he went back to the marketplace, because they were standing there looking for work to be hired. If they was already working, they wouldn't be in the marketplace. So, yeah, he went out about the third hour at the cross, and he found the disciples standing idle, and he hired them. And then he went, 1833, and he found William Miller, and he was idle in the marketplace, and so he hired him, and William Miller gathered about 50,000 people over the course of 10 years to follow. And so they were, William Miller was very much working in the kingdom, in the vineyard. Now notice that this vineyard that William Miller was working in, it was a Sunday-keeping vineyard, and who were the members of it? They were Lutherans, Presbyterians, Methodists, Baptists, they were Calvinists, there was a whole bunch of people from different persuasions that were following, that chose to follow William Miller. And said unto them, go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right I will give you. And they went their way. Again, he went out about the sixth and ninth hour. Sixth hour, 1833, William Miller, and about 50,000 people followed him. And the ninth hour, he found Ellen G. White, that she had been working with William Miller in his movement. And Yahweh chose her to head up the movement for the Seventh-day Adventists. And so Yahshua did likewise. He went there at the ninth hour, 1844, found Ellen G. White, and he hired her. And about the 11th hour, 2002, that's when the 11th hour struck, the close of the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing idle and said unto them, why stand you here all the day idle? Now this is the second time he mentions going out and finding people standing idle. That was in the first hour, early morning hour, with the children of Israel, Moses, children of Israel, coming out of Egypt. And when he went out, when Yahshua went out early in the morning to hire Moses wasn't idle in the marketplace. Moses was a shepherd out in the wilderness. He was herding sheep. He was very much busy doing the only thing that he could do at the time. And that's the only thing he knew to do. And when Yahshua introduced himself at the burning bush, he told Moses what he wanted to do. Moses finally agreed to it. Yahshua sent him a helper, Aaron, his brother, and the two of them went together down into Egypt. And so, but they weren't standing idle when he hired them. The only ones standing idle let's see. Anyway, they were standing idle at the cross for sure. The disciples were standing idle. They would have been working if they had been in charge of the temple, but they couldn't because the Pharisees wouldn't allow it. Okay. And saith unto them, why stand you here all the idle? And they say unto him, see, he went out again about 6 and 9. And then about the 11th hour he went out and found others standing idle. And that applies to Gilead Center 2002. And those that were standing idle were those that had showed up at the marketplace ready to go to work. Showed up there to go to work, but nobody would, and said no man has hired us. In other words, there wasn't any body that had a vineyard that needed any work done in it. So they weren't coming to the marketplace, these owners of the vineyards, to hire people to go to work because they didn't have nothing for them to do anyway. There wasn't anything to do on their farm. So that's the reason why the owners of vineyards, either their crops were already in, they've already harvested them, they didn't need no workers. But you always need workers year-round, no matter what. Okay, and saith unto them, why stand ye here all the day idle? They say unto him, because no man hath hired us. He saith unto them, go ye also into the vineyard, and whatsoever is right, that shall ye receive. Matthew 20, verse 1 to 7. How can we know for certainty in which hour we find ourselves, and if our own called to services come? Well, V.T. Hollis certainly didn't know for certainty just exactly what hour he was in. But he was getting close to it when he said the 11th hour in 1930, whenever the rod, he started the rod message. He said 1930, but he was premature. 1970 is the beginning of the 11th parabolic hour. V.T. Hollis thought it was 1930, so therefore he was 40 years behind, ahead of time. So it says when V.T. Hollis, he's asking the question, how can we know for certainty in which hour we find ourselves, and if our own call under service has come? We can know only by the establishing of the time in which the last parabolic hour expired. And to do this, we must first establish the time of the first call for service, then in turn the time of which of each successive call culminating in the last. First, though pursuant under this, then we must bring into focus the parable's significant points. Number one, the householder, as every Bible student knows, is the son, Yahshua, is his name, himself. Number two, for the laborers are his servants. Number three, for the penny is a reward. Number four, his vineyard is the place where they are to labor. And number five, the day is parabolical, representing a period of time which is illuminated by some great light. The period of labor is preceded and succeeded by a night. Else there could be no early and no late part of the day. The householder, number seven, let's see, the householder, labors at five different times. Number eight, there are 4 3-hour periods. Well, see, that's where V.T. Hollis made one slight miscalculation when he said there's 4 3-hour periods. No, there's 3 3-hour periods uninterrupted. But the 4 3-hour period is divided up between two groups of laborers, the fourth group and the fifth group, and the fourth group belongs to the Adventists. And so the last three parabolic hours on the time clock is 10, 11, and 12. And the Adventists had those, the first 2 hours, starting in 1844, they had the 10th and the 11th hour respectively. Okay, now they shared it with the Shepherd Rod and the Branch Davidians that come to Texas, the 10th and the 11th hour. The Seventh-day Adventists didn't have those two parabolic hours wholly to themselves. They had to share it with their daughters, the Adventist two daughters, which was the Rod and the Branch. V.T. Hollis represented the Rod, and Verus Johnson at Kermit, Texas, represented the Branch. So that's the two daughters that the Adventist Church had to share the truth with. That's the reason why the Davidians, the Shepherd Rod, was called Davidians, and that's why Verus Johnson should have named himself Branch Davidian if he'd had inspiration on that, on the naming of his church. That was what it would have produced. But Verus Johnson really didn't have inspiration on the correct name for naming the church. He named it 11th Hour Adventist Remnant Church, and he named it different names all through the years. He just didn't know what to settle on. That's because he didn't have inspiration on it. In each of the first three periods, only one group is hired, number 10. In the fourth and last period of 3 hours, two groups are hard. There it is, see? V.T. Hollis even admits it. Number 11 their agreement for a penny a day is made only with the first group. The other groups are to receive whatsoever is right. So who is the first group? Moses and the children of Israel coming out of Egypt. Well, you know something? Whenever he told each of those groups of laborers when he hired them at five different times, he always reminded them, whatsoever is right, I'll pay you. Well, the correct wage was a penny a day. So he did bargain with them. He did bargain with them. He said, your pay, if you get your name placed on the Lamb's Book of Life and you come to purification, he says then, this will be your pay, a penny a day. It means eternal life. All right. Now to find out which hour we are told, go ye also, we must hear at the outset of this, go to work, study, determine where the time the parable begins and where it ends. To gain this final knowledge is simply to reckon with the sequentially amplifying facts that the parabolical night which preceded the parabolical day must necessarily be the period before the spiritual light of the world of the Bible came up, before the light of the Scriptures, the written word of Elohim, began to shine forth into the hearts of men. For back there, it must be remembered, the will of Elohim was transmitted not by the Bible, but orally from Father to the Son, just as the light of the man, or the Son, at night is transmitted into the earth by the moon, rather than directly by the sun itself. For this reason, it has come to be regarded as a time of the oral tradition. But the day of the labor obviously represents the period in which the light of the world, the Bible itself, lightens man's path. Thus it is that in his parable, the master, the Yeshua of the vineyard, regards the Old and New Testament dispensations as the only day period of all probationary time. That he goes into the marketplace at the five consecutive times to hire servants to work in his vineyard. Now this is amazing. Yeshua is the householder, and he's the one that hires these servants to work in his vineyard five consecutive times over a 3,500 year period of time, from 1500 B.C. with the first early morning group of laborers, Moses and the children of Israel, until the last group, the group five in Matthew 20 verse 6. That's hard at the end of the 11th hour to work in the 12th parabolic hour that we're in now. And this is Yahshua. Five times he goes and he hires his servants at the beginning of each movement. There's five groups of laborers working at five, being called at five different times to work in the vineyard, in the kingdom. And they are called to head up a new movement with a new message five consecutive times. So you see why Moses was the first one called to head up. Yeshua went and raised up the disciples, and he placed Peter at the head of them. He gave him the keys to the kingdom. That's how we know he placed Peter at the head of the 11 disciples. Peter, over the 12 disciples. They ended up with 12 after he got rid of Judas Iscariot with Matthias. And then he hired William Miller in 1833 to be his servant over that movement of the 2300 year period prophecy. And then in 1844 he hired Ellen G. White, and then as the fourth one that he hired. And then the fifth one, he hired Elijah David, the one I'm speaking to you right now. So, contrary to what V.T. Hardiff taught, that he had a movement and so forth, and he thought he had the fifth movement, and the last, that would be the last movement. is he looked at the Bible, Matthew 20, he saw five groups of laborers. He said, well, I'm this last one. He didn't see anywhere else that there's anybody, another group to follow him. So naturally, he thought he was the last one. And I can understand why he talked to Rod like he did. But it didn't work out that way. Now, Elijah, David knows that this is the last one. Finally, the night following the day can only represent the period after the gospel work is finished, after probation for man's salvation is closed. Then, as the light of the world, the word of Yahweh sinks beyond the horizon of the day, darkness covers the earth and gross darkness the people. Isaiah 60, verse 2. It is a time which finds the destiny of every being forever fixed and follows the Yahshua's irrevocable finality. He that is unjust, let him be unjust still, and he which is filthy, let him be filthy still, and he that is righteous, let him be righteous still, and he that is holy, let him be holy still. Revelation 22:1. And I just got some inspiration as I was reading this. Folks, you know, we've heard this song, last evening sun is sinking low, a few more days and I must go. We've always heard about the final sunset, the sundown. Well, this world is going to have a final sunset. And it's pointed out there in Isaiah 24. That whole chapter describes the final sunset for this world. And Jeremiah 4 also describes the final sunset for this world. And it happens right here in this here 12th parabolic hour when the final sunset will take place. It's right at the end of the 6,000 years that's allotted for man's probation in sin. And so that's just a precious few years are left, folks. Okay. It says that finally, the night following the day can only represent the period after the gospel work is finished. Okay. When the final sunset takes place, then you're going to have 1,000 years of midnight darkness here on this earth, because it wanders as a tramp in the sky for 1,000 years without any light on it. It passes away into the night, into utter total darkness, because the sun and the moon stop shining. And when the sun and the moon stop shining, it means that this whole solar system is shut down. The only place where there's life at in the universe at the end of this world and at the end of probation, when all of the wicked are destroyed, the righteous are taken and translated into the kingdom of his dear son and the land of Israel, and then they're taken from there into heaven. And heaven is the only planet that will be alive and working during the millennium. It will be the only place in the whole universe, because all the stars have fallen. The heavens are rolled together to scroll, and they have consumed with a fervent heat. And Isaiah 24 talks about it, and Jeremiah 4 confirms it. And the earth, though, the earth doesn't disappear. It just goes into midnight darkness, because it just goes into orbit. It stays in the orbit that it's in right now. But we go to heaven for 1,000 years, and there's no sun and moon shining, because the light's been shut off from them. There's no moon and sun. They've all disappeared. The stars have all disappeared. And the whole universe, the whole galaxy of heaven, the billions and billions of stars have all disappeared. Because the Bible says he's going to create a new heavens and a new earth. Okay, when he comes back at the end of the millennium, he's going to create a new heaven and a new earth. So it shows that the earth is still here. If he's going to create a new one, it shows it's still here. You know why it's still here? Because it has a wicked dead on it. That has to stay in their graves for 1,000 years here on this planet while it while it revolves like a tramp in the sky for 1,000 years. And the thing is, it's not revolving around the sun. It won't be revolving around the sun during the millennium, because there's not going to be no sun there. It's just going to stay on its torso of going in that circle, but it's not going to have no sun there to give it light. Not going to have any moon. There's not going to be no stars. The heavens are going to be black, because they've all been destroyed. Yahweh has spoken them back out of existence. He spoke them into existence. He's speaking them back out of existence for 1,000 years. And then he's going to create new heavens and new earth and a whole new planetary system and a whole new solar system. Because the solar system has been affected by sin here on this earth. That's the reason he has destroyed the whole solar system. This brings the close of our study this hour. Contact us at the 11th hour call, and that's number 11. Click on our audio archive to hear this message and more. Let us close now with a song. End of our study this hour. Contact us at the 11th hour call. We're going to close now with a song entitled, What a Friend We Have in Yahshua.
What a friend we have in Yahshua. All our sins and griefs to bear. What a privilege to carry everything to Yah in prayer. Oh, what peace we often forfeit. Oh, what needless pain we bear. Oh, because we do not give everything to Yah in prayer. Every trials and temptation, is there trouble anywhere? We should never be discouraged. Take it to the Yah in prayer. Can we find a friend so faithful, who will all our sorrows share? Yahshua knows every weakness. Take it to the Yah in prayer. Every weak and heavy laden, cumbered with the load of care, precious Savior, still a refuge, take it to the Yah in prayer. Do the friends despise forsaking, take it to the Yah in prayer. In His arms you take and shield thee. Thou wilt find a soul to save.